As I travel through this land of sorrow, I am facing God's eternity, yet I never think about tomorrow,
God will
make a way for me,
I know my Lord will make a way for me, I know my Lord
will keep me glad and free, when I'm sad, all the friends I've had, they will come to make me glad, so glad. Matters not how lonely or how troubled I may be,
I know my
Lord will keep me safe from harm and every harm.
I know His
love will shelter from the storm, the raging storm. He'll be near when I fear, and my prayer He'll hear.
I know He'll make
my God will make a way for me, Every day I'm in the blessed keeping, in the keeping of the one who walked upon the sea, And someday when death comes o'er me creeping,
God will
make a way for me,
I know my Lord
will make a blessed way for me,
I know my Lord
will keep me glad and free, so glad and free. I'm sad, all the friends I've had,
they will come to
make me glad, so glad. Matters not how lonely or how troubled I may be,
I know my
Lord will keep me safe from harm and every harm.
I know His
love will shelter from the storm, the raging storm. He'll be near when I fear, and my prayer He'll hear.
I know He'll
make a way for me.
Are there some answers that man shall never have? Are there some things that man is not intended to know? In Deuteronomy 29, verse 29, we read, "The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." So, we will not concern ourselves with those secret things that belong to God. But how important it is for us to study those things which are revealed. Those things belong to us and to our children forever. We will work hard to learn about those things so we can use those precious truths for our benefit. These truths are so basic and universal. They are given to us and for us. What a shame to miss them through neglect or lack of interest. Won't you join us today for a few moments as we investigate the Word of God? Each of these lessons is available free on cassette tape. For your free copy of any of these lessons presented on this program, please contact me, Dr. N.C. Crouch, Hamilton, Texas.
When I'm feeling sad and blue, can't seem to know what's best to do, when it's hard to walk with men in sweet accord, when my plans have all gone wrong, when my poor heart has lost its song, I just kneel in secret prayer and tell the Lord.
Oh, I know
He'll hear my cry.
Yes, He'll
hear my deepest cry. I can count on Him, He's always nearby.
When my load gets hard to bear,
when my friends forget to care, I rejoice because I know He'll hear my cry. When through paths of tears I'm led, when I encounter fear and dread, strength I get from reading in God's holy word. I remember how in love my Jesus looks from heaven above. Sweet assurance comes to me, my prayer's been heard.
Oh, I know
He'll hear my cry.
Yes, He'll hear
my deepest cry. I can count on Him, He's always nearby.
When
it's hard to bear when my friends forget to care. I rejoice because I know he'll hear my cry.
Our study continues in the fourth chapter of Acts. We're ready to begin at the 20th verse, and at this point, Peter and John are now being examined by the Jewish council. They're standing before the Sanhedrin, and they're being asked why they have spoken in this man's name. By what authority do they have? And then Peter tells them how God sent his son, and they are guilty of having crucified him. And in verse 11, "This is the stone which was set at naught of you builders, which has become the head of the corner. Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved." But when the council heard this, they were most disturbed about this, and they were amazed that Peter and John were unlearned and ignorant men, but they marveled because they took knowledge of them that they'd been with Jesus. And they saw the man that they'd healed standing right there with them. They're living proof that a miracle had been done. There's no question about the fact that a miracle had been done. But this council was so intent on silencing this doctrine, on stopping these men from speaking in the name of Jesus and converting disciples to the cause of Christianity, that they were not so interested in the truth that they were willing to take note of the fact that this must be the power of God. And so they took Peter and John aside, and they had a little council among themselves, and what shall we do? And they decided that we'll just command them not to speak at all, nor to teach in the name of Jesus. That's what is stated in verse 18. And in verse 19, "But Peter and John answered and said unto them, Will it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God? Judge ye." And we talked about this verse in the last lesson, and it's a most important principle found in the Bible. It is one of the things that necessarily goes with the doctrine of God and those that follow the way of God. That is, there must be freedom in the area of religion. You must be able to practice the things that you perceive that God has said for you to do. This does not mean that God intends for man to do any and everything. This does not mean that anything that seems right is right, but it means that you must be able to do those things that you interpret to be the right thing. This is the freedom in the area of being able to make your choice. You must be able to make a choice as to how you worship God. You may be wrong. You may go to hell for it. You may lose your soul. But still, you must be able to make that choice. For if someone else makes the choice for you, it's really not going to do you any good, even though it be the right way. You have to make the choice yourself. That's why the Christian religion is one in which you work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And when you have the truth, you're going to have the same salvation and the same method of practice that everybody else who has the truth will be following. So he puts the question to this council. "You judge whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God." And then in verse 20, he begins to give a reason for why they're taking the stand that they're taking. He says, "For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard." We don't have any choice. We're going to have to speak the things we've seen and heard. And as we said, this is a very great principle. It's in favor of religious liberty, the liberty of conscience and a private judgment. You must be able to make this decision. Religion from the very beginning has been favorable to liberty. God has never been in favor of his people being slaves or in captivity physically or spiritually to others. When they were in the Egyptian captivity, his aim and purpose was to deliver them from that, and they were. When they went into the land of Canaan, they very plainly were not to take on the ways of other nations, and they were not to be in subjection to other nations. They were not to even borrow money from other nations. They were to be separate and independent and free to worship God the way that they saw fit. And of course, this would be the way that God directed them to worship. Even the Jews in later history never did make good slaves. When the Romans took them in slavery, they never gave up their Jewish ways. They never gave up their observing of the laws and commands of God, which was a very good thing and speaks well for them. It was interpreted by the Romans as being stubbornness, but it actually was a matter of being faithful to the principles that they knew. And this same principle was shown by the apostles and by the early church. When this doctrine was fresh in their hearts, they went forth to other lands, and they maintained it at the expense of their blood, and thousands of them fell as martyrs in the cause of liberty and in the ability to express their private judgment in religion. No men ever more firmly defended liberty than the early martyrs did. Each one that died, died in defense of a principle which is now acknowledged as the right of all men, the right to make your own choice as to how to worship God. Now again, we'd like to stress that we're not saying that every way that man chooses is right, that every way that man chooses is going to be accepted by God. Just because the conscience said it's all right, makes it all right, we're not saying that. But there must be the right for a person to choose the way that he or she wants to go. Because when somebody else starts choosing for you, you lose that liberty, you lose that ability to be your own free moral agent. And even if they had the truth and you're compelled to do it, simply because it's the law of the land, because you're going to be punished if you don't by some man someplace, this will not make you a faithful follower or servant of God. And so the designs and the purposes of evil institutions have been to destroy this principle. And this was the aim of the Jewish Sanhedrin here. And yet, when Peter and John appealed to their conscience, they did not tell what their true purpose was. They would not divulge what their true motives were here as they were trying to squelch this thing and stop this doctrine. So Peter and John tell them, we cannot but speak the things which we've seen and heard. And that is the attitude that we must have today. We must, first of all, have a clear feeling as to how we feel about something, what we do believe about a matter, the things that we feel and things that we've heard. They need to be implanted into our minds. And then that's what we speak. We speak what we truly believe. We speak what we truly have seen and what we have heard. And in the matter, or in the case of these apostles, they had seen the Savior. They'd been with him. They'd seen him resurrected from the dead. They had seen him in his resurrected form, talked to him, and were well convinced that he was certainly the Messiah, and they'd seen him rise into heaven. Now, if they had spoken anything else, if they had agreed to squelch this truth, if they had agreed to have modified this fact any, just because the law of the land wanted it that way, they would have been very dishonest people. They would have been not true servants of God. They would have been letting down on the great charge that had been placed upon them. And so we see they had no choice. They had no choice but to do what they had seen, what they'd heard. And so it is with us today. When we realize that the Bible is teaching a certain thing that is a truth, we must not let down on it. We must not back off. We must not in any wise be made to feel intimidated because we're trying to stand for something that we've seen and heard, something that we know that the Bible does teach. Now, this doesn't mean that we're not going to be open-minded or willing to look at other points of view, willing to search, willing to deliberate upon possible meanings of these various verses and just whether or not we could be wrong, examine ourselves over and over again to determine if we really and truly do have the truth. We're going to do that, but we still are going to do it in the light of having freedom to believe the things that we are convinced to be the truth. That must be allowed. That must be something that we stand for. And so the effect of this principle of allowing persons to believe what they can see and truly know, it allows the truth to continue and the truth to triumph. Even there are those that would want to stamp out the truth and want to change it, want to vary it so that their opinions are forced upon others. This principle of a person believing what he can truly see and know, a person believing the thing that he is convinced of, this principle then allows the truth to triumph. It allows such things as the Great Reformation movement to occur, in which the apostate church lost a lot of its power and the true church came back into view from its place of hiding and it became more available then to those who are interested in the truth. This principle will allow the truth to triumph. It doesn't matter what the tyranny is. It doesn't matter what the power is that tries to force a false doctrine upon the people. It doesn't matter what incentives are offered. This principle will keep coming to the surface. This principle of obeying God rather than men. This principle of only speaking the things which we've seen and heard. This principle is the one that's going to carry us through. And we must allow it then to be the ruling thing in our lives when it comes to determining whether to obey God or whether to obey men. So after Peter and John have stated their full confidence in this great principle, verse 21 says, "So when they had further threatened them, they let them go, finding nothing how they might punish them because of the people. For all men glorified God for that which was done." The council didn't find any other way that they could get away with punishing them. They still had an eye on how the people felt about this. They were still trying to please the people because, to a large extent, they were still political animals. And this meant that they had to, for their survival then, allow the general feeling of the people to somehow or other affect their actions. So because the people glorified God for what was done, the people really looked upon this as a great miracle, and as these men being from God, with the power of God, then they let them go. But before they let them go, they further threatened them. They let them know in no uncertain terms, "We're not going to tolerate this. We're going to be against you. We're going to do all that we can to put an end to this thing." And the apostles certainly took this into consideration. They realized this was a great authority that they were dealing with, and they didn't take it lightly, even though they couldn't go along with it. They certainly took great note of it. So verse 22 says, "For the man was above 40 years old on whom this miracle of healing was showed." Again, Luke is reiterating and the point that there's no question about the fact that this had to be a miracle. This wasn't a baby that hadn't had a chance to walk yet, or this wasn't someone that had been walking and then suddenly for the 2 or 3 days he couldn't walk again, then he had this great cure. This was a person who hadn't walked for 40 years. He was over 40 years old. He'd never walked from his mother's womb from the time he was born, and everybody knew him and was well aware of the fact that this person couldn't walk. And so it was a miracle or a case in which it was quite evident that a miracle had been done, no question about it. So verse 23 says, "And being let go, they went to their own company and reported all that the chief priests and elders had said unto them." So now the apostles are let go. They've been turned loose on this threat that they must stop teaching in this man's name. They must stop spreading this news about the Messiah, about his resurrection, and about the fact that they'd crucified the Son of God. This had to be stopped. And so the first thing they did, they went to their own company. That is, they went to the other members of the church. They went back to where the church was gathered. And maybe not in a formal assembly, but it was where they were staying together. And so they went back to their own kind. And this is one of the first things that we need to do when we're in trouble, is be able to turn to the church to give us some kind of assistance in our time of trouble. "And they reported all that the chief priests and elders had said unto them." So they let the matter be fully known to the other members of the church. This is where we stand in this community with the political authority. This is what the chief priests and the elders said unto us. This is what was told us. And they're in a quandary now because they have to make a decision. What are we going to do? What's our next move going to be? How are we going to handle this thing? They had several choices. They could do what the council had told them to do and just be quiet about it all and not say any more to spread the gospel. Or they could leave Jerusalem and go to other communities and mark Jerusalem off as a lost cause, which certainly wouldn't be very well because were going to encounter this opposition probably any place they went. Or they could defy the authorities and do the things that they knew they had to do to please God and depend upon God to help them. Several choices here, and it seems that none of them were real good choices from the standpoint of what's going to be easy and comfortable. Nothing's going to be easy and comfortable to do that were among the options for them to choose from. So we find, though, that they did the right thing here. After going to their own company, verse 24 says, "And when they heard that," that is when the other members of the church heard what had happened, heard what the council had said to them, "they lifted up their voice to God with one accord and said." So they go to God in prayer. And this is a very important thing, because it's something we must always be willing to do ourselves, and we must do it. Not just be willing to do it, but we must do it. Go to God in prayer. So they lifted up their voice to God with one accord. That is, they were all praying together. Maybe one was leading the prayer at a time, but the rest were listening and going along with it. They were praying together, and they were doing it with one accord. And we keep having this principle of the unity of the church being mentioned in the book of Acts. They didn't have divisions. They didn't have schisms. They weren't going this way and that way, but they were now in a state of unity, harmony, and they were praying to God together with one accord. And this prayer is recorded here, and it's a very elaborate and deeply meaningful prayer. To learn the principles and lessons taught in this prayer are going to better educate us in some of the workings that God has with the church. And so as they begin the prayer, they said, "Lord, Thou art God." Now, this first word here for Lord is not the most common word used to mean Lord. In the Greek, it means despota, and it's the word from which our word despot comes from. And it means, actually, one who is the ruler, the one who rules over others. And it was applied to the very highest magistrate or officer, and so it denotes authority, power, and absoluteness in ruling. Now, this is significant because the council had just implied that they could overrule God, that they could tell them to do things that were contrary to what God wanted them to do. And so as they approach God, they re-establish the fact that they definitely regard God as being the absolute ruler. He has even authority over the council. He has authority that the Jewish Sanhedrin didn't have. No other power up on earth could have authority that this God has. So the first word of this prayer is a word that's translated as Lord, but it means the one who has absolutely authority in ruling. You are the ruling power. You are the sovereign power of all the world. And this is an appropriate approach to make, because they're making a choice now as to which power are we going to place over the other one. Are we going to place the local power, the political power of the Jewish Sanhedrin, first in our lives, or are we going to place the power of God the Father first in our lives? That we have to make a choice here. And there may come times in our lives when we have to make a choice. And if we do, how are we going to approach the great God? Are we going to call him by a name that would imply that he has supreme authority over all other powers upon this earth, and that what he says is going to then take precedent in our lives over what any other authority says? That's what these apostles were doing as they prayed here with the church. So, Lord, that is the supreme ruler of the universe, Thou art God. Now, this second word here for God means that he is the one that has the power. He is the one that has the right to do with him what he wants to do. So not only is he the supreme in authority for ruling, but he also is supreme in his power to do what he wants to do. Thou art God. Now that they've introduced these two thoughts about God, they then substantiate this with a quotation from the 146th Psalm. Thou art God which hath made heaven and earth and the sea and all that in them is. This is Psalm 146, verse 6, showing that this God has all ruling authority and he has all power because he made all these things. He made heaven and earth and the sea and all that in them is. And if we'll just stop for a moment and contemplate what the significance of that statement is, it'll bring home the fact that they were trying to get across as they made their statements, as they made their decisions. If God is able to make heaven and earth and the sea and everything that is in heaven and earth and the sea, all animals, all creations, all creatures, all heavenly bodies, all earthly bodies, everything that has to do with nature, all the plants, if God is able to do that, and certainly this gives God a unique position in all the world, all the universe, that no other being has, and no other being can even challenge, and no other group can challenge. What audacity is it then for any group, no matter how large or how powerful or how popular, to oppose the will of God, knowing that God has done all these things? God didn't just have this right given to him. He didn't just have somebody to vote him in as the God, but he has absolutely earned and deserved the privileges that he has, his unique authority and his unique power, by the fact that he has made everything that's here. He's put us here. He's put all of our blessings here. Everything that we are able to experience in this life is something that God has allowed to be here. God has created all the things that we know as things of material wealth, all the things that we know as things of natural wealth and beauty, all the things that we know as laws of the universe, the laws of physics and biology and mathematics and the laws that have to do with keeping the heavenly bodies in their orbits. God's put all these things here. So he has very high credentials. He has every right to expect that he is going to be recognized and looked upon as the supreme power and the ruling authority. So when he makes a law or a rule or a principle, it behooves man to obey that. It is a shameful thing for anybody to come along, when I say body, I mean any group to come along and to try to impose something different on others. It's a very shameful thing for an individual to assume that these are not necessary things for him or her to take note of, because they come from the supreme authority. And as they introduce this prayer and they refer to this Psalm 146 verse 6 as a quotation, they're simply showing that they recognize God for the position that he truly does hold. Now we're just starting the prayer, but we've come to the end of our time for this portion of our study, so we're going to close at that point, and then Lord willing, next time we'll begin with the 25th verse and continue this great prayer that you're making to God. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
Here I stand with chains around me, wondering why these bars surround me. A slave today am I, bound by chains of my own choosing, by myself the fight I'm losing. Oh Lord, please hear my cry, set me free.
The chains to melt away.
Ooh, lead me to the light of day, O Lord, a slave no longer to be.
Let me walk in the soul.